Hi, it's Haley, and it's Thursday, which means you're listening to a brand new episode of How We'll Live. Thanks so much for being here. If you've been enjoying the show, it would mean a lot if you rated, reviewed, or shared with a friend. To stay up to date when a new episode drops, just hit subscribe. Okay, today we're talking about virtual reality. When you hear that, you probably think of a big Google headset where you can escape to other unknown worlds, maybe even play a game or become someone else. But in today's chat, we're exploring virtual reality as a therapy for children with autism. Vijay Ravindran is the co-founder and CEO of Floreo, a groundbreaking research and venture-backed virtual reality therapy system to aid parents and professionals working with children with autism. He's an accomplished entrepreneur and technology executive with experience in online retail at Amazon and the news media industry for the Washington Post Company. His career spans digital commerce and news media. He joined Amazon in 1998. Remember Amazon in 1998? When the company just sold books and music. What a different world. He later served as the director of the ordering department at Amazon and led the team that launched Amazon Prime. I'm sure you have a few Amazon Prime boxes sitting in your house or apartment right now. As chief digital officer for the Washington Post Company, he founded WAPO Labs and oversaw the development of over a dozen products in digital news and launched Washington Post Social Reader and Trove, a personalized news web application. He's an engineering graduate of the University of Virginia and serves on the board of the Lenfest Institute, which develops and supports sustainable business models for local journalism. During our conversation, you'll learn how Vijay's position at Amazon really opened the door for him to pursue his passion. The inspiration behind Floreo and the incredibly cute first employee, Floreo's first steps, and their partners and supporters who helped get the product off the ground. The affordability and accessibility of technological therapy versus human therapy. The fears and challenges that come along with starting this type of venture, being the creator of a product that's the first of its kind in the world, and as a parent of a child with autism. Determining real-world progress, and where Floreo stands right now, where they hope to be 10 years from now, their cutting-edge technology, and their dreams to change the world of virtual and augmented reality training tools. Okay, let's explore this whole new world with Vijay.
Well, Vijay, I am so excited to have you on the show today. Before we dive into the questions and learning about you and the product that you're building and the incredible technology that you're creating, I just want to say, from a personal perspective, I think that the work that you're doing, leveraging technology at the intersection of health, is so innovative and purposeful and can really have a huge impact for people living with autism or, any type of socializing challenges. And, by creating this tool to help them interact with the world and free them of some of their struggles is really profound. I was watching some of your content on your website before we chatted, and I watched the video with one of your partners. And one of the things that one of the teachers said, and I'm just going to quote it because I felt like it was so powerful and such a good demonstration of the work that you're doing. She said, "So many students tell me that their mind is so disconnected from their body and they wish they could leave it behind. In the world of virtual reality, suddenly a child who feels that way feels empowered and they feel like they have control and there's a love for their world that's a whole different experience for them." And I love that. It really resonated with me. So, thank you so much for creating this product and for joining me today.
Oh, you're very kind.
I'm only repeating the work that you're doing. Well, your background is very diverse, and you can kind of correct anything that I'm missing here, but you were an executive at Amazon when they sold just books, right?
Well, so I joined right after music, but before VHS video tapes. So I joined in 1990. Yes. Believe it or not. Yeah. So I it's a good way to date myself. So I joined in the summer of 1998, and Amazon had just expanded its US business from books to music. And I joined right before video. and right before they started international expansion. So I was a pretty early software engineer there. I wouldn't necessarily call myself an executive for my time there in that, you know, I was middle management by the time I left. I did oversee a group of product management and engineering that was well over 100 people and owned some pretty important areas of the company for sure. So
cool. Well, now I think it's a lot of people's dream to work at Amazon. They're kind of, well, it feels like they're taking over the world in some way. And I know that you were there when they launched Amazon Prime, which I would guess at least 95% of the listeners here have an Amazon Prime box sitting in their house somewhere. And then following that, you were at the Washington Post. So I would love to learn more about your background and your career path and sort of what led you down the path of technology. I mean, technology is such a great industry to be in now, but I feel like technology is really having a moment. So tell me about your background.
Yeah. I mean, really starting at the beginning, you know, I started as a software engineer at essentially a consulting firm that built gnarly telecom billing systems for big phone companies. And, you know, the way I got hooked into Amazon was not because I had some master strategy and clairvoyance that was going to be a big deal. It was simply because my then girlfriend, now wife, had gotten into University of Washington to do her PhD. And so I moved out to Seattle and essentially took the first job I could find, which ended up being a software developer at Amazon in 1998. And so, but it was, of course, an incredible experience and, you know, turned out to be an amazing ride through the 7 years I was there. And I left in 2005 again because my now wife had finished her PhD and she had gotten an offer from the University of Maryland to join their faculty. And so, you know, given how difficult it is to find academic jobs, we decided to focus on helping her get her career off the ground. And so I quit Amazon and moved out to Washington, D.C. I had volunteered on the Kerry campaign in 2004, in Washington State, just as a door-to-door canvasser. And some of the Amazon colleagues I've worked with had actually gotten into really engaged roles on the Kerry campaign. And so when we decided to move to Washington, D.C., they suggested that there could be some really cool tech opportunities in politics. And so when I moved out here, I started looking around and I ended up meeting someone named Harold Ickes, who had worked in the Clinton White House and had essentially a business plan of trying to get a data mining and data warehousing company off the ground to help Democratic and aligned organizations do political campaigning. And so I was the founding CTO for a company that's still going called Catalyst that works with pretty much every big Democratic aligned organization that's doing voter campaign activities. Ended up working closely with both the Clinton and Obama campaigns in 2008. And after the presidential election, got approached by Don Graham, who was the CEO and chairman of the Washington Post company, to take on a role there. And so my role there was looking at the future of news and different ways that the Washington Post could innovate to handle all the changes. And I oversaw a labs group working on experimental news products, looked at investments that the company could make, and worked closely with the Washington Post and Slate and some of the other properties owned by a larger holding company to work on digital innovation.
Wow, that's a big responsibility.
Yeah. And I think to go back to philosophically, I think when I was leaving Amazon, you know, the nice thing about that experience is that people recognize that the technology of Amazon is something special. And so it's given me the freedom to be able to apply that into areas that I feel passionate about. So, you know, first in politics and then in journalism. And now with Florio. And so it's provided me a great launch pad for doing things that are both technologically interesting, but also matter at a different level.
Absolutely. And I think that for all of us, integrating passion with purpose and our career makes the day feel so much better.
Yeah, that's the dream. to me, the dream is being able to use your day job skills, but applied to causes that really matter. Everyone spends so many hours a week on their job, funneling that into things that have purpose. Just, you know, practically speaking, goes so far compared to any donation you can make or volunteer activity outside of your work that you can do. Your work is where you spend a ton of time. And if you can organize that in a way that it can also, you know, satisfy the kind of contribution you want to make more largely, that's really a great scenario. And so I've been fortunate enough to be able to find those channels for the last 10, 12 years.
That's great. That makes me feel so happy. I feel like the pursuit of passion is definitely the big dream. Have you always been someone who's had the latest technology around? You know, when the iPhone was released, were you the first person out to get it? You know, you're working in VR now, which is so far advanced compared to what most of us have lying around our homes. Have you always been into it?
I think fairly so. I was a little late on the iPhone. I didn't have an iPhone 1, mainly because I was playing around with, people don't remember this now, but there was this very cool Nokia mini computer called the 880, and it had its own open source operating system, and it had the potential to be an iPhone competitor. And of course, they completely messed up the business side, but the technology was really neat. And so I was playing around with that and kind of missed the first iPhone and only got in on the second iPhone. But aside from that, I'm usually about as early as an early adopter as you find.
That's great. I am probably what you would consider a late adopter in terms of technology. When the iPod first came out, I remember being so anti and wanting to do something that was different than everybody else. So I got a Dell jukebox, which was just like an MP3 player because I didn't want to be like everybody else. But I'm learning to adopt, and that's exactly why I started this podcast, because I recognize the impact that technology can have on our everyday lives. And, you know, with the passion that I have in health and wellness, understanding how we can improve our lives by leveraging technology and working at that intersection. So I want to talk more about how you're doing that, you know, how it came to be and how you developed Florio. So at what point did you leave the Washington Post?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, the Washington Post kind of left me in that I was part of the team that sold the Washington Post to Jeff Bezos. So I was working for the holding company that owned the Washington Post, along with a number of other properties, including Kaplan. And, you know, we put the Washington Post up for sale. It was sold to Jeff Bezos, who, of course, I'd interacted with at my time at Amazon. And he'd actually been a reference to Don Graham when I joined the Washington Post. So it was very a small pond. And I decided to stay along with my team with the Graham family's holding company, because we were working on an incubated startup idea that was around personalized news called Trove. And so we launched Trove and decided about a year and a half later to shut it down. And so I left at the end of 2015, what was then called Graham Holdings, which was the new name of the Washington Post company.
Got it. And is this when you started developing the technology for Florio?
I was dabbling. I mean, so the first instance of the idea came right as I was about to leave. My son tried out virtual reality for the first time. He was 6 at the time and diagnosed with autism when he was 2. And he tried out VR, really liked it, and got into some pretend play and conversations with my wife and I. And so my wife had the idea initially of, hey, I wonder if this could be a therapy medium. And so the next thing I did over the next few months is I bought every VR headset that I could get my hands on, started sampling dozens to eventually hundreds of VR applications that were out there. And then where appropriate, bringing my son in to try stuff out and kind of, I just wanted to see how he'd react to different experiences. So I was doing that in January, February, March, while also taking calls on potential next opportunities. And then eventually just got very excited about the potential of what we were doing, that I thought there was a, you know, beyond it being a cute application, that there was a real shot at building something that could meaningfully improve lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with your son being diagnosed with autism at 2 years old, I'm sure you and your wife have such an emotional connection to the product and anything that could help your son experience the world in a different way. You know, how can we do more of this?
Yeah. And we identify with the parents that we meet. We meet so many families now who in many ways are where we were 2-3 years ago or 4 years ago, kind of processing the diagnosis and figuring out a plan of action. You know, I think the thing people on the outside don't really understand is when your child gets diagnosed with a developmental delay like autism, there is no handbook. There is no firm guidance from a doctor on exactly what to do. There's no medical, you know, pharmaceutical regimen you just go on to. It's the parents end up shouldering this incredible responsibility of figuring out the right path. You know, they have to really play this general contractor role and pool together these different types of areas of expertise to try to help their child. And it's daunting.
I can only imagine. So what was that like for you and your wife? I think that they're people are becoming more aware of autism. And from what I read, and you would know more about this than myself, but the diagnosis of autism is increasing. And I'm sure that that can be a really isolating feeling for families and for parents, not knowing how to make their child's experience wonderful and not really understanding how to navigate that process, especially once they go to school and trying to make friends and having the childhood that they anticipate.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, starting with, I think both my wife and I were high achievers. And, you know, the first step is you have to get off of the achievement superhighway that parents get on, where there's a lot of kind of everyone's competing with each other, whether, you know, subconsciously or consciously. And once you're in this state, you have your own unique path to forge on how to help your child blossom to their fullest potential. And so that's a big challenge. And, you know, we were fortunate that our diagnosis was on the early side because there were some telltale markers. And as a result, we were able to start a lot of the interventional therapies sooner than we would have had had we got the diagnosis later. And so that's, that has allowed, you know, our son has done wonderfully as far as developing, and he's a joy to be around. And so for parents, there's just an incredible amount of pressure to act quickly, act efficiently and smartly. And there's very difficult choices around sacrifice. So in my wife's case, you know, we made the decision that, you know, she would step back from her tenure track faculty position to supervise therapies that we needed to essentially take him to. And while we could have hired someone to potentially do that, we wouldn't have then had the type of insights we had around when things had stopped working or plateaued and when to change. And those were really key aspects.
And no one knows your child like you do, right? And you have a different connection. And I saw Manoj in some of the videos trying the different, you know, he's like a little mini Florio employee almost. And he does look like such a joy to be around.
Yeah, he'll tell you that he is an employee as of 2018. Somehow he decided that he crossed whatever threshold of volunteer to employee. So it's great. He loves demoing Florio and he loves getting people to try it out. We've had this really awesome relationship with the Please Touch Museum in Philadelphia for the last year, where once a quarter they have a special needs event. Basically, they open the museum a couple hours early, keep the lights down, keep the noise down, and allow families with kids with special needs to take in the museum at a very small capacity. And it's quiet. And so they invited us a year ago to start also showing Florio to families. And even though it wasn't launched and publicly available, it gives hope. And my son loves being able to talk about it with families. And if kids are showing hesitation, hold their hand and take them to it and get them comfortable. And so it's been fun to watch.
That is the sweetest thing I've ever heard. I just got chills when you said he wants to hold their hand and make them feel comfortable. And it probably gives him a sense of ownership too, and it very empowering to be part of this product. So you mentioned that the museum will dim the lights or make the music a little bit quieter, and I'm guessing that this is part of the sensory component of that people with autism experience. So maybe it would be helpful for you to explain some of the neurological differences of someone with autism or someone without autism and sort of how they experience the world differently and what it means if someone is on the spectrum.
Yeah. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm not a doctor nor a clinician or a psychologist, you know, but I have met now hundreds of kids on the spectrum as part of my job. The first thing you learn very quickly as you interact with dozens of kids is how different autism manifests and how different the different kids behave who carry a diagnosis. There's some commonalities, but it's very hard to say anything in a blanket fashion. You know, autism, you know, is defined by a delay in social skills development combined with, obsessive or compulsive areas of interest, which can also be repetitive actions. But there's a whole host of things that travel with autism that are not necessarily part of the diagnosis, but tend to be common. One of which is either sensory sensitivities or sensory seeking. And so, you know, some kids are very sensitive to light, tags on their shirt, extremely picky eaters. Meanwhile, other kids might want to be spun around and will never get dizzy. They might really seek tactile feedback, which was the case with our son. So when he was very young and right as we were getting the diagnosis, he really liked to break things. So any glass he could get his hands on, anything that he could kind of create a ruckus around, he sought that sensory feedback. So those are kind of some things. But essentially, you know, key developmental milestones around social development end up being delayed. And the children also have deep interests, kind of ranging from deep interests to kind of repetitive actions also, which can sometimes become distractions to, basically, as a parent, the thing you learn very quickly is there's a big premium around having a child develop the skills that they sit in one place and can essentially be education ready. And if you don't achieve those goals, then there's a whole host of opportunity to shut off. And so there's an incredible amount of pressure to help a child get to this place where they can actually receive education. And so you don't miss this, it really feels like a train that's leaving the station sometimes.
Yeah, and especially today, I feel like the pressure of education and the pressure for children to pass standardized tests when each child's mind and body is having a different experience of information. So adding in these types of difficulties would make that even more challenging. So when you first had Manoj try on the VR, what was he experiencing with that first headset?
Yeah, well, he tried out Google Street View, which had just come out in VR. And he was walking through a neighborhood, basically, and then wanted to go to the Starbucks, which is one of our favorite activities. I think what was really good about what I saw was that he understood that what was going on in VR was not real, but it was immersive enough that he was really happy and could essentially stay there and be satisfied by the experience of being real enough or engaging enough. And so that's what we paid attention to and saw. The other game that he really got into was essentially a virtual reality version of Crossy Road, which is that mobile copycat of the old Frogger game, for those old enough to remember. But in VR Crossy, which is the Crossy Road version, you are trying to cross the street in a series of highways and train tracks and stuff and not get hit by cars. And I was impressed that he understood the controls needed to essentially execute the game. And so it gave me confidence that he understood the VR environment enough that he understood how movement should happen in the environment. And so that gave me more confidence that that children could potentially grok the VR scene environment and understand the basics that, you know, as you move your head, the display updates. And if you see an arrow, you can move forward and kind of understand the change of the position in the scene.
why was it surprising to you that he was able to understand and execute on those cues?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's really fascinating is that if you put a VR headset on a lot of adults, they will not move their head. Like, this whole concept that the video updates based on your head, where your head is positioned, does not come naturally. And so, but kids get it immediately. And so I think it's yet another example of where kids that are digital natives are able to do things off the first bat in ways that adults don't intuit immediately.
That's so interesting. I guess that's the power of technology in modern society. What was the next step for you in creating your product? And just to take a little step back, for people listening who don't know what VR is, because we have only referred to it as VR, stands for virtual reality. So those Oculus headsets that you've seen around, that's what we're referring to. So what, you know, Manoj tries this on, it works, you're seeing really good results from it, surprised by how well he's, you know, working with the product. So what's your next step with Floreo?
Yeah, so as I referred to earlier, really the next step was a deep sampling of the virtual reality space. I bought Oculus. Oculus was not, the consumer version was not available yet, but there was a developer kit available. And so I bought that. I bought a number of headsets for mobile phones, Samsung Gear VR, eventually an HTC Vive. I basically really wanted to get deep into what experiences were available today and how do they present themselves and where was the industry going around what's possible. And then along the way, trying out some of the experiences with Manoj to see how he reacted and developing a point of view about what types of controls they could understand right off the bat versus which ones were much more difficult, especially if a child is having developmental delays around their occupational skills. And so really designing the napkin version of the product we have today by experientially going through everything that's possible and seeing how my son reacted to the ones that looked promising. That led to, you know, eventually deciding to bring on our chief technology officer, Dr. Ali Moini, who had been a software engineer who had worked on the Washington Post Trove labs team that I had led in my previous job. And he has a very interesting background because he's an experienced mobile software engineer, but he also has an MD and a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. And so he had a lot of understanding of what I was looking to accomplish. And so he was our first employee. We started putting a little bit of money behind the company to bring him on and start buying equipment and trying to build that first version prototype. And so that he started in April, and by the end of May, we had that first version prototype. And so in June, I was able to get it in front of a couple of investor types and a couple of clinical people. And we essentially brought on an experienced clinical therapist as a consultant, as well as a pediatrician, both of whom we later hired full time, Rita Salarzano, who has a 20 plus years of experience working with kids on the spectrum, and Dr. Sanan Tonashilagu, who was last at Children's National and is a neurodevelopmental pediatrician and is now our chief medical officer. And so they were consultants helping shape the product. So by the end of the summer, we got to a place where people could get their arms around what we were trying to do. And we started developing our first set of lessons in an area of intervention. And in parallel to that, started trying to find the right partners who could help us pilot. We decided very early on, you know, led by my wife, who did a lot of the background research on the intersection of VR and autism, safety, that we needed to invest in research early to show that virtual reality-based training could generalize to real-world skill development. And there just wasn't a body of research that already existed that validated what we were trying to do. And so we had to make the decision that we had to build that ourselves. And so we started looking for partners, and two key ones emerged. the school Celebrate the Children up in northern New Jersey that we ended up doing our first research study with the following summer, and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and their Center for Autism Research, which we currently work with on a few different research projects, the main one of which is funded through a large NIH grant that we won last fall. And so that really got the company in motion as far as validating that virtual reality could be used for to help people with autism. And for the next 6 to 9 months, the main challenge was really building out the content to do that training so that we could conduct those research trials.
Great. And so what was the first content that you built out based on that research?
Yeah, so we focused on a developmental area called joint attention, which is a skill that develops pretty naturally at around 18 months for kids, but it's being able to share an experience with another person. So probably the simplest example for people to grok is, you know, if I point at something and then say something about what I'm pointing at, you know, you can see what I'm pointing at, and you don't need me to use the noun of what I'm pointing at in the context of what I'm saying verbally. You're able to merge that recognition of what I'm pointing at and what I'm saying, like, oh, that's cool. You know, something that otherwise would be nondescript. And so so joint attention is a really early skill area that's taught for kids who have a developmental delay. And so we started building a set of scenes that take place in a safari park, and the child who's wearing the virtual reality headset appears on the back of a pickup and can view the animals, but is safely inside of the bed of the pickup. And then we created exercises that worked on various aspects of teaching joint attention. So an adult would be in the back of the pickup, point at one of the animals. And if the child looks at the animal, an animated reward would appear to reinforce the proper behavior. In another scene, the virtual reality learner, the child, would look at an animal, and the animal would start moving across the safari park. And if the child can keep their eye on the animal, then they would get a reward for tracking the animal properly. So we created basically these scenes. And had this been taught in a traditional method, a therapist might use little toys, you know, toy trains, things on a table to kind of move around. And you know, in virtual reality, we can create a fully immersive world to teach those skills in a way that actually ends up being more natural, because it's closer to the real world situations of exercising those skills. And so it was pretty exciting. And we were able to build those scenes out and then eventually be able to, you know, run research against it.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So essentially, would you consider it kind of like an incentive-based game for the kids who, when they have the headsets on?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have different definitions of what is a game. You know, it's an experience where you are rewarded for actions that we're trying to coach and reinforce. So based on where you look, when you look, we're able to reinforce that the behavior is appropriate using animation. And so we essentially take advantage of being able to track the head in virtual reality to then be able to do things in an automated fashion. The other part that is powerful about Florio is that we stream the view that the child in virtual reality has to an iPad, and that iPad can be used by an adult to coach in real time as the child is going through the experience. And that also enables the adult to, in other cases, manipulate the characters in the scenes to create the social situation that we want to help reinforce. So in some of our scenes, the adult is able to, from the iPad, have a character in the VR scene point at one of the animals, and they can choose which animal to have them point at, because children sometimes respond differently based on whether it's something they want to do or not. In other cases, there might be particular dialogue that we want the character to deliver to the child. And so we give the adult the ability to choose the appropriate dialogue for the situation. The other thing that we're able to do in the Florio system is that as the child goes through a VR lesson, we're able to also assist the adult with suggested language to use while they're going through it, ways to help them based on what we're observing in the virtual environment. And so there's almost a teleprompter element to the way that an adult interacts with our iPad application. And the real goal around that is to coach the coach and to make this something that's powerful enough that it can help parents engage their children in addition to professionals.
That's really fascinating. So it's almost, the benefit is twofold. You're benefiting the child, but also providing added value to a family or to a teacher who's using the technology alongside that child. And maybe even, you know, is there an element of strengthening that relationship too, or creating a deeper understanding?
We hope so. And then on a practical level, there's simply quite a bit of training required to help a child build skills, but in a more constrained environment like the ones we create in virtual reality, we're able to coach an adult to engage them appropriately without that training, potentially. And so in our minds, that's what opens the door for parents to be able to contribute more to helping their children than they are able to today.
Right. Why do you think that the technology, that using technology to do this is more powerful than human teaching one-on-one?
Yeah, I mean, beyond the aforementioned training curve, but, you know, families with a child with autism face affordability and accessibility challenges. Affordability in that insurance coverage is not consistently there for families across the U.S., and only certain types of training and intervention is covered in most cases. And so there's simply a cost factor that, you know, when my son started the main breadth of his therapy, you know, the cost of therapy he was going through was many tens of thousands of dollars a year. And so if you don't have the right insurance coverage covering that, you know, it can be, you know, pretty much impossible for the average family. There's also major accessibility challenges where there's simply not enough trained therapists in the U.S. to deliver the types of face-to-face therapy that they would need. And so it's not uncommon for a state, for the rural counties and states to not have any licensed therapists. And so there's major logistical challenges on families to have to commute to the major population centers to get therapy. And there's some pretty compelling statistics on the household incomes dropping by about a quarter after a diagnosis because one of the spouses essentially goes to part-time or stops working altogether, which was our case.
Right. The implications, you know, go beyond the diagnosis. There's a financial implication and accessibility implication.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And so what we think is powerful about virtual reality is there's a bunch of advantages. In the professional context, we are creating an experience that potentially is more engaging than the traditional methods, giving them a tool in the toolbox. We're able to capture metrics in this pure digital environment to show progress, which is not really captured today in traditional therapy, and can be a great supplement to communicating between the professional therapist and the families how the child is improving certain skills. In the school context, we're creating ways for special education teachers to be able to teach skills they might not have training to do without the aid of something like Floreo. And then ultimately, when you look at parents are the most incented to help their kids. They have the most time to devote, but that time frequently is going to be in the evenings, on the weekends, not during the day. And so the power of something that's purely digital delivered like Floreo enables them to step into contributing in hopefully a big way because they're not bound by the constraints of how traditional therapy works today.
What has been the biggest challenge in this whole process?
Well, there's been a lot of challenges. I think, you know, the first and most important one is, does it actually work? And so, you know, building enough of the product to be able to then run research and to be able to confidently say Floreo can help is a big milestone and one that we've made a lot of progress on. And we're able to say it with certain caveats that can't. The next challenge is, you know, as we're building out the catalog of intervention content in Florio, is what's the best way of getting this into people's hands? You know, families receive services through the healthcare system, through the special education system. Sometimes in the case of the healthcare, it's covered by payers, sometimes it's out of pocket. Sometimes parents are stepping into doing things outside of those that they feel strongly could help. It's a diverse market. And so, you know, for us, it's as much a challenge to figure out the right way to product and package what we think is a compelling capability so that it can actually be put into use.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure that any type of technology presents so many different types of challenges. And then when you get into healthcare and navigating that system presents even deeper challenges. Yeah.
The other thing that, if I can just jump in, one other point to make that I left out is that the other big challenge is simply most of the families we meet and the kids who try out Florio, this is the first experience in virtual reality for both the child and the parent that they've never encountered it before. And that's just because, you know, virtual reality is not, you know, a household commonplace device and capability that people have had. And so so there's also a hurdle of simply, it can feel a little scary to use this technology you've never used before. And, you know, it's incumbent on us to be able to make it easy enough to use and approachable enough that it's not so daunting.
Yeah. Is there a fear for parents using this system with their child when I know sensory is a challenge that children with autism face? So are they worried that when they put this headset on that it could trigger some of those reactions?
For sure. That was the biggest concern that professionals raised early on when we were merely talking about the concept but didn't have anything built yet. It was a major focus of our first research study of Celebrate the Children to simply see whether kids would tolerate wearing the headset over a 5-week period. The good news is that using a few simple acclimatizing strategies that the teachers helped us develop, we were able to get to a 98% session completion rate over those 5 weeks, the kids participating in the study. So what was a concern is less so. What we've been able to show now through multiple research studies is that the children enjoy virtual reality, and after initial potential hesitation because it looks different, they get comfortable enough. And once the headset goes on, they're able to lock in. We're able to accomplish that by having some starter experiences that are easy to get around and kind of fun before they get into the meat of the actual learning that we want. In other cases, we've learned from working with the school, Celebrate the Children, that you know, having a child watch another child go through it. So in some cases, just having the child watch another child through the iPad app to see the child go through the experience puts them at ease, and then they're able to put the headset on. In other cases, having some sort of physical grounding, so a teacher putting their hand on the thigh of the child while they're in the VR environment puts them at ease. So we've created now a basket of ways to help a child get comfortable that seems to work pretty well.
That's great. Being able to overcome that obstacle is probably huge in getting that into the hands of people. How have you seen the training from Florio translate into the real world?
Well, so the first study we ran, which was around joint attention, the way that we approached really trying to show real-world progress is by applying benchmark diagnostics on the skill we were coaching in the real world with the children prior to and 4 weeks after the study. And so, you know, the real key is to develop assessment. In our research is to develop assessment tech approaches to look at where they are on a particular skill, apply Florio for whatever time that we define the research to do, and then wait for a little bit of time. So in our case, we did 4 weeks, and then reapply those benchmarks. And that's what we use to to basically say that we saw improvement in 10 out of the 12 kids in the case of that first study.
Wow. And what were the main improvements that you saw from the children during that study?
Well, so the benchmarks looked at subsets of joint attention. And so it actually measured the children's ability to initiate an interaction, to respond to and ask, to do things like shifting their eye gaze. And so then we essentially remeasured those observations using the same benchmarks 4 weeks after the study ended, and then looked at the deltas. And so some kids showed improvement across all three of those factors. Others showed across subsets. And in all 10 of the 12 kids showed improvement, at least one of the main areas. And then what we did then is we circled around, and the research study we ran was actually presented at a digital medicine conference called Node Health last December. And we were fortunate to also win an award as a top evidence-based pilot at the conference. And so we've been able to create a level of comfort amongst schools and therapy clinics looking at Florio based on that first set of research.
Congratulations. That must feel pretty amazing. Where does the product stand right now? What's next?
Yeah, so we have a handful of schools and therapy clinics who have early access. And for anyone listening that's interested, you can go to our website to fill out the Getting Started form, and we'll get back to you if someone wants to be an early adopter. And so we have Florio deployed in about a dozen places, and we are preparing a more fulsome parent-facing release of Florio for later this year. And really, you know, we're at this stage now where we're looking for the right customers and ways to get Florio into the hands of both parents and professionals looking to help kids.
That's amazing. What would you say if you were to look, you know, 10 years into the future at what Florio is accomplishing? What is that overarching mission and vision?
Yeah, so, you know, I think in 10 years, you know, we'll continue looking at cutting-edge experiential technology, whether it's virtual reality or eventually augmented reality and other forms of creating experiences to help kids like the ones we're helping right now, hopefully broaden the ways we help so that we can go from youngsters just off a diagnosis, working on very basic social skills, all the way up to job training and, you know, really adult issues that are important. And, you know, right now our society spends a lot of time trying to help kids right after the diagnosis. And we do a fraction of that to help 18-year-olds with autism get to college, or a college graduate with autism find a job and adjust the workplace to help them. And so there's lots of opportunities for Florio to play a role across those. And the other dimension that I would hope expands is that, you know, we're really building the world's first supervised intervention platform in virtual reality for teaching skills to all sorts of people, but with a real focus around developmental delays. And so I would hope, and we see early signs of this with some of our school partners, where they're using existing content with children who don't have autism diagnoses. And so there's a real opportunity for Florio to expand into areas such as ADHD and anxiety and other developmental areas, where the power of a simulated environment and being able to practice and work on your skills can lead to better real-world performance.
Wow. That's really powerful, Jay. And I'm so happy that we had this conversation. I feel like I learned so much, and you're wisdom and technology has so much to offer everybody listening. Is there anything that people listening could do that would really support you and the product, or what can we do?
Well, I think all of us are, you know, if not 1 degree separated, but a couple of degrees separated at most from people impacted by autism and other major developmental delays. And I think, you know, helping spread the word that there's a product could be helpful. That to come to floriotech.com, which is our website, and get the people that might benefit from this aware of what we're doing. And, you know, we're keeping everyone up to date, but we're also looking for advice from the community on what's the new content to be building. Where are the struggles that families are encountering? So, you know, really, I think for those of you who might know a family that is challenged by autism and other areas, you know, just building that community out so that our product can evolve to help as many families as possible is really, really the biggest way to help.
Isn't that technology amazing? And I just loved the stories about Vijay's son. How cute. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. I'll be back here next Thursday with a whole new episode, and I hope that you'll join me. If you'd like to learn more about Vijay and Floreo, you can visit their website at www.floreotech.com.